and basically went behind the backs of the Israeli Army General Staff
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And, well, this evening, for the first hour, we're just going to have open lines, and we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So give us a call. We'd like to talk about what you'd like to talk about. I thought maybe I'd start out talking a little bit about the outlawing of DDT. Now, that may not sound very exciting to a lot of you, but you have to stop and think of the implications. You know, we're so concerned about the threat of bird flu. And do you know that almost 160 or 170 people have died throughout the world in the last 3 years from bird flu? Now, the avian influenza, this H5N1 disease that they keep talking so much about, has been around since 1959. It's sort of a non-issue. There are a lot of people in China that have antibodies to it. They've come in contact with the disease, and certainly their bodies have taken care of it. This is a non-issue. And yet, over the last 33 years, almost 100 million people have died of malaria unnecessarily because the United States banned malaria back in 1973, not because it did any harm. It was the safest pesticide that we've ever known, but because it was saving so many human lives. And there are many people who believe that there are too many people in the world, and, well, we'd be a lot better off with an awful lot less people. And those of you who've heard me talk on this subject will remember I often quote Jacques Cousteau, who, writing in the November 1991 UNESCO Courier, talked about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. And people say, that's crazy talk. Nobody could want to do that. But you have to really understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're involved in a spiritual battle, and there really are people out there who have a whole different worldview, and they think there are too many people in the world, and they outlawed, of course, the use of DDT here in the United States, and then the United States Agency for International Development put pressure on countries throughout the world, specifically in third world countries, to ban DDT, and it became almost impossible to get. And you didn't get any loans from America if you didn't do what we wanted. And here in the United States, DDT had literally just done away with malaria. We used to have malaria in our southern states. But after using DDT for a decade or so, malaria is no longer really a threat at all in the United States. But it's very much of a threat in third world countries. It's estimated that somewhere between 300 million and 500 million contract malaria in impoverished countries every year. Now, a lot of them will just get shakes and shells, and with treatment they'll get over it. But it's estimated that up to about 3 million people a year die. Don't believe when they tell you it's only 1 million. They know what's going on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and once again, We're coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And this is open line, so if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'd love to hear from you and talk about what you'd like to talk about. But I'm talking about the tragedy of the outlawing of DDT. And, you know, in so many of these poor countries, the people are already impoverished and you have malaria, chronic malaria, and you can't accomplish much of anything and you're laid up for weeks or months at a time. And as I say, the figure of death is about 3 million a year. Now, it is said that, you know, every 30 seconds a child dies of malaria in Africa today. Every 30 seconds, a child dies of malaria because they're so much more susceptible. And where is the outcry? And, of course, it's deafening in its silence. But if you agree that there are too many people in the world, if you agree with people like Bertrand Russell, who in his book, you know, The Impact of Science on Society, page 103, and incidentally, if you'd like to document what I'm saying, I'll be glad, of course, to provide the pages because I got permission from the people who published this book to put this out. If you'd like the pages, we'll send those to you, 103, 104, and as I remember, page 50, where Bertrand Russell talks about through the use of diet, injections, and injunctions, we'll be able to mold the minds of people so that they will be the sort of people that the government wants, and any thought of criticism or rising up or objecting to what's going on would just be totally impossible. And then on page 103, he talks about if we could just have a black plague sweep the world every generation, why, that would be wonderful. It's much more effective than war in killing lots of people. And, of course, malaria would be comparable to the black plague that killed, you know, 30 or 40 million people in Europe, certainly in the Middle Ages. It's killed about close to 100 million, about on average 3 million a year. And if you don't believe that, go up on Google and type in malaria deaths of 3 million people a year, and you'll find that what I'm telling you is true. But because of the degree of control over the mass media in the United States, most people have never heard what I'm saying. And as a result, approximately 3 million people have died for the last 33 years. And, of course, that gets pretty close to 100 million people. And yet, of course, everything is being done to effectively block the resumption of the use of DDT in those third world countries that need it. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly if you're out there listening, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because this is Open Lines Wednesday, and the first hour of our Wednesday program, we'd like to do open lines and talk about what you'd like to talk about. And we were talking about malaria, and the great tragedy of what's happened is this was really banned in the United States in 1973 after almost 7 or 8 months of hearings where they found that the DDT was the safest insecticide ever found. And all of the things that you were told by Rachel Carson and the environmentalists really aren't true. The softening of the eggshells, how many people have heard of that? And yet what happened was they ran an experiment with birds and they took the calcium out of their diet and they fed them DDT, and you'd never guess what happened. Why, the eggshells were softened, and they published an article, and I forgot whether it was Science or Nature, those prestigious publications, which everybody thinks are so accurate. And then, of course, what happened was when a friend of mine, Dr. Edwards, who taught biology over at San Jose State and was really a good friend until he passed away a couple of years ago, but Dr. Edwards went to the author of that article and said, you know, this is totally illogical. Why would you do a study on the strength of eggshells and take the calcium out of the diet? Why don't you repeat the study with calcium in the diet and then DDT and see what happens? And that's what they did. And lo and behold, the eggshells were normal or maybe even a little stronger. And as a result of that, when they tried to resubmit the article to the magazine that had published the original article, they refused to publish it, to print it, and they said we would never publish any article that supported the use of DDT. And so the false information was put into the medium. As with so much of what we call science today, it is simply a sham, and these people should be ashamed of themselves. But you see, there are people who have this different world vision. In fact, you know, as you, many of you may know, I spent many years with an organized medicine trying to get the disease we call AIDS treated as a normal public health issue and try to stop its spread in America. And for a decade, I worked my heart out on that, and I spent a lot of money and time and effort and sleepless nights and calls. And eventually, after 10 years, I got the members of the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association to agree to an effective public health policy, only to find that the leaders of organized medicine had no intention of carrying out the dictates of the doctors. They organized a new committee that was made up of homosexual activists, and they actually refused to carry out the dictates of the doctors. Why? Because there is an agenda. AIDS is being used for population control. Here in the United States and throughout the world, I had the hardest time really accepting that fact for a long time. It certainly violated everything I believed about the goodness of man and certainly the responsible positions taken by public health officers and the CDC. And it wasn't until I went to the CDC and talked to them there that I realized the CDC is not there to protect us. It is a political organization. It has a political agenda, and it's responsible for so much suffering and death. But the one thing you can say about the CDC is it has a good press corps, it gets good press consistently, and most people think that the CDC and the Federal Drug Administration and the National Institute of Health are there to protect you. And let me tell you, after analyzing this over a period of well over 20 years, I'm firmly convinced that they're not there to protect our health. They're there in many instances to carry out a program. It's called population control. I'll never forget going to see Jim Curran, who was the medical officer, the chief medical officer in the public health service at the Centers for Disease Control, who was responsible for the AIDS epidemic and handling the public health policies. And Jim Curran was a nice man. I really liked him. We had an opportunity to talk for a time, and I told him, you know what needs to be done. I know what needs to be done. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, but everybody knows when you have a sexually transmitted disease, the first thing, the logical thing, the primary thing you would do would be to try to find out who has the disease and try to stop them from giving it to others. That's the logical thing to do, and you do routine testing instead of doing testing and putting every sort of a barrier in the way to actively discourage doctors from testing their patients. And then you do routine testing in the hospitals. But they managed to block that by requiring pre-test counseling. Now, when was the last time you went to the doctor and you're going to have a blood count done to find out if you have leukemia or some other blood-borne disease? And the doctor sat down and spent half an hour counseling you about the implications of that disease. Now, let me tell you, before we do this blood test on you and then find you have leukemia, if it's found that you have leukemia, why, you may very well die. You may very well have to have chemotherapy, and all your hair is going to fall out, and you'll be deathly ill. Now, just roll up your sleeve, and we'll go ahead and do this test for us. And how many people do you think would have a blood test after you painted this terrible, horrible picture for them? And that's what doctors were supposed to do as far as AIDS was concerned, and spend 15 to 30 minutes counseling the patient about all the implications of the disease before they did the blood test on it. And this was designed specifically and intentionally to discourage people and discourage doctors from doing testing. Why? Because they didn't want to stop the spread of the disease. It took me a long time to really accept that. Now over 500,000 Americans have died of this terrible, terrible disease, and 1 million are infected and going to die. It's a totally unnecessary epidemic. And those of you who haven't read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, let me suggest that it is still available from Radio Liberty. You know, it was very interesting. We had this listed on books in print, and as soon as we'd get it listed on books in print, somebody would go in and take it off of books in print. And we did this time and time again, and time and time again, somebody came along and just took it out of books in print, and the book was not available. And we do have the last remaining supply of those, and it's an important book. We've recommended to you. Although, certainly I did not understand when I wrote the book what this was all about, population control. My book is primarily about the politics of AIDS and my experiences as I tried, along with a few friends, to address this terrible plague from a public health point of view. Throughout the world, between 20 and 30 million people have died unnecessarily. Throughout the world, about 50 million people are presently infected. And what is being done from the normal public health point of view to address the epidemic? Well, recently here in the United States, after 20 years of unnecessary death, the Centers for Disease Control has recommended that we start doing the routine testing for AIDS that I recommended, you know, almost 20 years ago. 1986, 1987, 1986, as a matter of fact, and it's taken them 20 years to get around to recommending that, but in other countries like Botswana, where in Botswana, 46% of the pregnant women who are tested there, and they do routine testing on all pregnant women for HIV disease, 46% of those women are HIV infected, and faced with this terrible human tragedy, what is being done? Well, of course, the medical officers in Botswana want to start doing routine HIV testing on everybody in the population to find out who's infected, and they've been attacked and vilified. How dare you try to do that? And so they want to continue the same genocidal policy that is underway today. Well, my telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'd love to hear from you, and perhaps you'd like to talk about what's going on in Iraq or Iran, or maybe what's happening in Mexico, or what's happening financially to our country. The open lines, of course, is predicated upon you out there in the listening audience giving us a call. But I think one of the most difficult things for me to ultimately recognize was that there is a population control agenda, not only here in the United States, but throughout the world. Here in the United States, it involves abortion, and that's the reason, of course, why the Supreme Court in 1973 determined that they would, of course, a woman had a right to kill the child within her womb. That is behind this drive for euthanasia and the Terri Schiavo tragedy. This is what's behind water fluoridation, because water fluoridation actually decreases fertility significantly. It decreases the sperm count, it decreases sperm mobility, and it increases the incidence of Down's disease. And it comparing groups, communities that have, of course, water fluoridated and unfluoridated water, why they found that the higher the level of water fluoridation, the lower the fertility, the lower level of fluoridation, the higher fertility. So they know these things, and the scientific studies are there. Anybody who would like to see those studies, they're available at Fluoride Alert. You can go to that website, fluoridealert.org. Don't go to .com, because, of course, somebody else has put a website. I think that the government has put up a website at fluoridealert.com to confuse you. And when you go there, well, you're going to find out how wonderful fluoride is, but they're simply poisoning the American people with fluoride. And they know that it decreases the intelligence. They know that in areas where the water is fluoridated, you have a significant increase, about triple the number of people with an IQ down around 70 and no geniuses. And if this is true, why doesn't every American know? And it simply reflects the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. My telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and give us a call, and we'd love to talk to you or talk about what you'd like to, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and there's so many instances that and things we could talk about the population control agenda. As you know, for instance, that thimerosal, the substance that they put into the influenza shots, decreases fertility in animals, and not only in the animals that are given the thimerosal, doses that are comparable to what are given to our children, have been given in the past, and now are given to 6-month-old children. And, of course, now, of course, they've changed the recommendation for that, supposedly. Oh, they're going to take the thimerosal out of all vaccines, childhood vaccines, that is. But they're leaving it in the vaccines that they give to 6-month-old children, and it is now recommended that pregnant women be given the thimerosal containing influenza vaccine during the first trimester, when it'll do the most damage to the unborn fetus, the unborn child in that woman's womb. And we know, for instance, that there have been studies that show that thimerosal in the vaccine increases the incidence of abortion in human beings and certainly in pregnant women. We know that certainly it does this in animals, but what's really so significant is that it actually increases infertility for generations yet unborn. In other words, several generations of animals where the parent has been given the thimerosal, their offspring and the next generation and the next generation have much lower fertility levels. Could that be why some of the richest men in the world, who I believe are affiliated with this population control movement, people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, people who've been fantastic amounts of money, are so intent upon giving vaccines to children in third world countries, but vaccines that contain the full component of thimerosal. You see, here in the United States, when it became apparent that multiple vaccines, you were giving very, very high levels of thimerosal, of mercury. I mean, there's no safe level of mercury, but the EPA has given a ridiculously low level for, you know, the safety of mercury. But they found that the children were getting 85 times the amount that was allowed by the EPA, and I think that was by the time they were 6 months or 2 years of age, because of the multiple thimerosal-containing vaccine. So about 1999, why the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I believe in conjunction with Centers for Disease Control and a couple of other organizations, decided to take the thimerosal out of the childhood vaccines, the regular childhood vaccines in this country, and it was all supposed to be out by 2003, by the year 2003, but they let them use up the supplies that they already had. Now, it was harmful. Why would you let them give something harmful to children? And, of course, you hear this plea from public health officials, why if this was going to be harmful to children, why we would never allow that. And I would like to suggest that you must get your thought process correct. There really are evil people out there. And there really are evil people who want to hurt children. And that is why they allowed them to use up the vaccines, childhood vaccines that contain the thimerosal, and they've recommended it be left in for the vaccines we give to children in third world countries. Why would we give them something that would harm them? Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, if you have a subject you would like to talk about. But let's perhaps shift the gears to what's going on with Iran and the fact that it would appear that our administration is intent upon going to war with Iran. And the trouble is that most Americans really don't understand the implications of what's going on. And I have a lot of good friends who support the president and what he's doing. They have read the studies and the reports, and it's all really historical true that certainly Muhammad was basically a raider. They raided convoys, camel caravans going through his area. And this is, of course, how he began to build up his army. You know, you either convert to my religion or you'll be dead. And so an awful lot of people did. And of course, he did have some, very, very strange sexual proclivities, having married a girl who was 5 years old and consummated the marriage when she was eight. And of course, the Muslims did spread across the Near East and the Middle East and North Africa. And they did invade both France and Spain, and they were eventually driven out of Spain in 1492, and they stood at the gates of Vienna in the 1680s. And had it not been for that courageous stand there by the Christians, why, of course, the Muslims would have taken all of Europe. But that is past history. And after, of course, the defeat of the Muslim hordes at the gates of Vienna, the crumbling of the Ottoman Empire, the Muslims, which at one time had a very, very progressive, society and civilization, they really began to steep into decline, and because of certain stipulations within the Quran, which prevented a monetary system such as developed in England and the West, while the Muslims were never able to develop an industrial base or a highly industrialized society as did Europe, England, and, of course, the United States. So the Muslims then, of course, really were not much of a danger to anybody. And, of course, after the First World War, when Turkey was defeated, England went in and set up all sorts of unstable states in the Middle East, and Iraq is a perfect example of that, where they combined three warring groups: the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunnis, and they did that so you'd have an unstable situation, so you'd have to have a dictatorship there, and so that the English could play that dictatorship against other dictatorships, and that was known as power politics, and they did the same thing as far as establishing countries like Jordan and Palestine, and certainly back Saudi Arabia. But they set up all sorts of unstable situations in that part of the world. Well, of course, we fast forward to where we are today. And the current administration seems to be intent upon going to war with Iran. Now, you have to go back in history remembering that it was in 1953 when you had a democratically elected government in Iran. And it was at that time when the CIA went in and toppled the regime of a man named Mossadegh, placed him under house arrest for the rest of his life, and installed the regime of the Shah of Iran. And although the Shah was an enlightened dictator, he was still a dictator, and there were many people, of course, who did not like living under the dictatorship. But the Shah actually was raising the living standards, generally as far as the people was concerned, and he had the support of the vast masses of the people, until the CIA in 1979, under the direction of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is certainly an employee of David Rockefeller's, until Zbigniew Brzezinski and the American CIA toppled the Shah's government and actively brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. Now, back in 1979, I can remember this very well, and I thought to myself, why in heaven's name would we have toppled a man who was our friend? At least he was very pro-Western, he was anti-communist. He was the bulwark of anti-communism in the Middle East, with the sixth largest military in the world, largely provided by our own government here. Why would we topple a friend and put into power an enemy? But you must understand, ladies and gentlemen, that everything that is going on today, I believe, is following a cosmic script. And I believe, of course, bringing the Ayatollah Khomeini to power back in 1979 foreshadowed what's going on today. Well, if you'd like to give us a call and you'd like to talk about this or some other subject, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I had a good friend on the other evening, and when the subject of Iran came up and Iraq and, what were we going to do about the conflict with the Muslims? He wanted to really bomb them back to the Dark Ages, back to the Middle Ages. And I was shocked, and yet I suppose I shouldn't be, because you see, the propaganda out there is doing everything they can to make us hate the Muslims and to make the Muslims hate us in preparation for what I fear is World War III. Well, this is Arthur Stan here at Radio Liberty, and Gers, we're looking for your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But the question comes up as to why we are so intent upon going to war with Iran. Now, the Bush administration claims that Iran will kind of have nuclear weapons at any moment, and I've talked to people who are within the intelligence agencies who tell me, oh, yes, that's really true, but if you read the New York Times and so many articles I can give you, you'll find out that the Central Intelligence Agency insists that Iran will not be able to build a nuclear weapon for 5 to 10 years. In fact, their figure is 10 years, and you know, more than that. Do we have any absolute proof that they want to build nuclear weapons? Certainly, they claim that they want to put in, nuclear energy, nuclear power plants. And, of course, people say, well, why would they want to have nuclear power plants? They've got all that oil there. Why would they want nuclear power? And one reason is that President Ford, back in 1976, convinced Iran that they should have a nuclear power plant, and they began working at that time to develop the background to this plant that is under construction today. So we encourage them to go into nuclear energy and enrichment of uranium and all of these things. We did that 25, almost 30 years ago. So why are we so upset that they're carrying out the recommendations that were made so many years ago? And I think it's so vitally important that people understand that everything seems to be like it's following some sort of a master plan that I believe, of course, is leading us into World War III. Now, we're told, of course, when we attack Iran, it'll just be a little short war, maybe just a couple of weeks, and we'll just drop, a few thousand tons of explosives and destroy their capacity to actually build nuclear weapons. But how many people out there in the audience think that we're going to attack Iran, that they're not going to counter by attacking us, by trying to cut off our oil supplies, by actually hurting us? I mean, that would be the way that most people in other countries would act. That's certainly the way we would act. Iran is of no threat to the United States. And yet our leaders have gone against the recommendations of the CIA and have an active campaign to convince the American people we must go to war and we must hate the Muslim people. In fact, this is a carefully coordinated plan. And if you read the we'll talk about this in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and this is Open Lines, and we'll be with Jeannie in just a minute calling from La Selva Beach. But it was just a few days after the 9-1-1 attack, maybe 4 or 5 days or a week at the most, when it was either Newsweek or Time magazine to put out a special edition. And in that special edition that came out immediately after the 9-1-1 attack, all about, of course, the tragedy of what happened at that time, but it concluded with a call for hatred. And I'll never forget reading that and wondering what in heaven's name they were up to, because they basically talked about the necessity of learning to hate. And until we could hate with a true purple hate, why we were not going to be effective in the coming war. And it was at that time was my first glimpse of the fact that what was going on was part of a carefully conceived plan. And, of course, it's a long-range plan, and I think that that long-range plan is going to involve America in World War III. Well, let's go to Jeannie, who's calling now from La Selva Beach. Hi, Jeannie. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine, Dr. Stan. You know, this name came across Dr. Robert A. Pastor, and he's the main author of the article Towards a North American Community, bringing together Canada, United States, and Mexico. And I thought, now I've heard that name before. And it's very interesting because right now he's the vice president of international affairs and he's also a professor of international relations at the American University. So he is a insider, and in 1977, he accompanied Mrs. Carter, President Carter's wife, to Central America. And he was actually the advisor, the security advisor for the White House. And so there's a great book that talks about him, and it's actually written by President Somoza, and it's called Nicaragua Betrayed. And it talks about Robert Pastor going down with Mrs. Carter, and they visited all the Central American countries, including some South American countries, and they were really, what Robert Pastor was doing was telling the heads of government down there that they wanted, the United States wanted General Somoza out. And so this goes back to September of 1977. So here's a guy, a professor in our university, teaching all this socialist Marxist philosophy. And so it's like we are being occupied now by the communists, socialists, Marxists, and they're all in Washington, D.C., and, of course, our governors are going along with a lot of the programs like Agenda 21. But this is amazing, Dr. Stan, how these same people stay in the government and they just change roles. And this was way back, what, 30 years ago?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Jeannie. And the thing is that there is a plan that's being followed, and they want, of course, to do away with the sovereignty of the United States. And they know exactly what they're doing. And they have been planning this for a long time, and you're right. This whole idea of building a North American community, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, is all part of a plan that was laid out by Mr. Pastor. And he is, of course, as you know, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, this whole thing is coordinated by this little group that controls the leadership of both parties, that controls our media, that controls our banking. And if you've never read the cursing article about the Council, written by Richard Harwood, who is the editor of the Washington Post for many years, and he just tells you they control everything in this country, and most people have no idea what's going on. They are traitors to America. Yeah. They want to destroy this nation.
Well, there was a conversation between one of the ambassadors, Bowler, and he talked with President Somoza. And this is what he said, that he told President Somoza the Carter policy was to see that all of the right-wing governments in Central America be replaced, and that Nicaragua would be the first to go. And so it doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. If you go along with the globalists, then they'll put you in and protect you.
Well, I think we've got a real problem. I think there's a long-range plan, and I think it's time the American people understood that they want to betray us.
You know, Jimmy Carter, you see him going around with his peanut smile, and I'm thinking, what a traitor, just like he toppled the Shah of Iran, and then President Somoza down in Nicaragua. And so it's so sad that he represents Habitat for Humanity and helping the poor people, and meanwhile he wants to actually destroy them and kill them. And so here we have the ex-president, Carter, going around and actually being a mediator in a lot of the problems in Central South America and through other parts of the world. And he's the traitor. And so somehow people do have to get educated, and I'm glad you're there, Dr. Stan, about this.
We'll do our best. And of course, I would simply point out that President Carter was picked by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who we're just talking about, the man who brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power in 1979. and also toppled Somoza that same year. God bless you, Jeannie.
Okay.
Thanks so much for calling.
Good evening.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. We've got sort of Ron calling from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Well, hi, Dr. Stan.
Let me just give our telephone number out again. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead.
Well, I think you're a little too kind to the Islamic faith. At least some of the comments you made there.
All right, fine. Go ahead. What would you like to say?
Well, I think if you get down to their basis documents and you know, the behavior of their founder, it's a very violent, intolerant religion.
You're absolutely right. How many Muslims do you personally know, though, that are violent and ruthless like Muhammad was? And most Muslims.
Well, I'll tell you, Stan. If you get someone out of, let's say, into the United States, where they're that tiny minority and the culture is still very much, we still have very vestiges of our Christian liberties here, they're not going to be violent.
All right, fine.
But you go to the Middle East, where they're in the vast majority, and do some street preaching, and you'll find out they'll behave quite a bit differently.
Well, what do you think we ought to do with them, Ron?
I have to say, I do know some Muslims. I was active in the Christian Coalition, and one fellow with whom I work was he had helped build a mosque up in the nearby town, and he even took some Christian Coalition literature and handed it out in the mosque. But his knowledge of the Islamic faith was not very great. I think he was probably more of a universalist than anything else. Capital U, universalist Muslim, small m.
Well, I think,
but I also knew another fellow who was very devout, and I hadn't seen him for several months, and the first thing he started talking to me when I met him again was how bad the Jews were. Look what the Jews are doing now. We've got to get rid of the Jews.
And I think you're right, Ron, but I think what's being done is everything to get them to hate, you know, the Jews, and to get the Jews to hate the Muslims. You went into, for instance, into Lebanon, and for many years you had about 50% Muslim, 50% Christian. They lived together in peace, and they had a wonderful, wonderful land. Everything is being done to create hatred. To create hatred on the part of Christians for Muslims and Muslims for Muslims for Christians. There's an organized campaign to actually foment it. Let me just read you something from Time magazine, their special after 9/11. For once there is no fatuous rhetoric about healing. Healing is inappropriate now and dangerous. There will be time later for tears of sorrow. A day cannot live in infamy without the nourishment of raids. Let's have raids. What's needed is a unifying Pearl Harbor sort of purple American fury, a ruthless indignation that doesn't leak away in a week or two. Let Americans explore the rich reciprocal possibility of the fatwa, a policy focused on brutality that does not come easily to a self-conscious, self-indulgent, contradictory, diverse, humane nation. America needs to relearn why human nature has equipped us all with a weapon called hatred. And
well,
believe me, they're doing a great job.
We should hate evil, Dr. Stan.
We should, but should we hate all Muslims? And that's what
absolutely not.
But then, Ron, what would you do today? What would you do today about the situation in the Middle East? Do you think we ought to go to war with Iran?
Bibles.
What?
That's what I do.
What?
I start handing out Bibles to people.
You're absolutely right.
You know, the one thing that will get you in trouble in the armed forces, like right now, is if you did something like that.
You're absolutely right.
I mean,
the only solution to problems that faces mankind is Christianity. The only solution to the problems in the Middle East and in the Near East is Christianity.
Well,
what we need to do, of course, is to try to get people, you know, not to hate one another. And right now, if you've got so much hatred between the Jews and the Palestinians and the Palestinians and the Jews, I don't know that you'll ever be able to solve it. And
well,
the same thing now is developing, you know, between the Jews in Israel and the people in Palestine, in Lebanon. But my fear is, of course, we are being manipulated into a war with Iran that is going to turn the entire Muslim world against us. and had not only that but engender hatred for America. All throughout the nation, there are people who are actively preaching hate. What I read to you was obviously written, I believe, long before 9-1-1, in preparation for 9-1-1, with this idea of engendering hatred. That came from a special edition of Time magazine that was sent out free all across America immediately after 9-1-1 to engender hatred. Now, why would Time magazine do that? There were no advertisement. There was no profit in it. But, of course, they have an agenda, and that agenda is hatred. And I don't want, you're absolutely right. What we need to do is preach Christianity, and what we need to do is, of course, try through our activities and through our example to make people want to be Christians.
Yes, well, that's part of it. But if someone is just bound and determined that his religion says to kill infidels, we live in the house of war, according to the Muslim theology, and we'll have a choice, either become a Muslim or have him kill us. Well, that's Christianity. You have, it's a religion of choice. Whosoever will, let him drink of the waters of life freely.
Darcy, but you see, we are not being attacked by Islam today. We have a war on terror, and yet the president has refused to close our borders. Why, if there is really a threat of terrorism, had the president consistently, for a five-year period, refused to close our borders?
Sir, and I completely agree with you there. I would think it's almost impeachable what he's failed to do. I guess you need a writ of mandamus to make him do his job. But that's kind of a different subject.
No, not really, because the whole idea is that most people really believe we're involved in a war on terrorism. And, you know, the terrorists are threatening here, and as President said, far better to be fighting them on the streets of Baghdad than the streets of the United States. Well, if we really have this terrorist movement, why, after 5 years with our borders wide open, have there been no other major attacks in the United States? And I don't think that the average Muslim really wants to strike America. If you read the full staff report of the 9/11 committee report, you'll find out that most members of Al-Qaeda did not want to attack the United States. It was only Osama bin Laden, who'd worked for many years for the CIA, and the CIA had passed up time after time, opportunity after opportunity to catch him 11 different times, according to one book we carry called Missing Bin Laden, another book we have written by a fellow from the CIA who was in charge of the Bin Laden desk. We had 10 opportunities to catch Bin Laden, and he was consistently protected by the CIA. And if you read the 9/11 Commission staff report, they will tell you that the people in even Mullah Omar and the leaders of the Taliban and the leaders of Al-Qaeda did not want to attack the United States. It was only the man who'd worked for the CIA who did, and who, we don't even know where Osama bin Laden is. How could it possibly be that after 5 years we haven't been able to find him? Is it possible that maybe most of what we believe just isn't true? I mean, I don't know if you know the story of Ali Muhammad, but Ali Muhammad was supposedly a double agent, pretending to work for America, but really working for Al-Qaeda, responsible for the attacks on the American embassies in both Tanzania and Kenya. And yet, although he was taken to court, he was never convicted, and nobody knows what happened to him. And there's some of us who think he was a double agent. He was actually working for the CIA and responsible for that terrible tragedy in Kenya and Tanzania. And that sounds so impossible, and yet we know from recent revelations that the number two man in the Irish Republican Army was a British MI6 agent, that the chief torturer for the Irish Republican Army, a man who was torturing and killing people who were accused of being British spies, was actually working for British intelligence. Could it be that maybe we've infiltrated the very heart of this whole terrorist movement, and that's why we've not had another attack here in America? I just say that, are we being manipulated? You're right. We need to push Christianity, but we're not going to do it when we have good people saying, let's bomb them back to the Middle Ages.
Well, I don't think, I mean, you talked to Bill Federer, I don't think he said that.
He did, right. I was shocked when he said it. And Bill's a good friend. I love Bill.
Have you ever had Tom White of Voice of the Martyrs on?
Let's see. No, I haven't. I know who he is. I've had the gentleman who preceded him, who actually set the organization. Yeah, I did have Tom on one occasion, though. What does he have to say?
Well, I just got his latest newsletter about Indonesia, and there's some terrible Islamic persecution of Christians.
Absolutely. I'm sure there is.
And I don't think, it seemed to be kind of spontaneous.
Well, I think it's being promoted by the government over there. I think that the government is promoting all of this sort of thing. And who's financing and keeping their government in power? This is one of the big things that people do not understand, that our government, is funding governments that carry out our policies. And in many parts of the world, we fund the people who are killing Christians. And you remember what happened in Rwanda when they slaughtered 800,000 Christians? And what did our government do? Absolutely nothing.
Well,
that was when Clinton
and Madeleine Albright were running things.
Absolutely, and you remember what happened in Bosnia? We were backing the Al Qaeda people, the Al Qaeda Muslims. What about in Kosovo? We were backing the Al Qaeda's against the Christians. There, we'll be back. Hang on, we'll be right back in a moment.
Sure.
Well, go ahead, Ron.
All right. Well, I just think that the Islam, those who believe in the basic tenets of Islam, to me, they cannot also be adherents to the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, I think that you're absolutely right.
There's no reason that, in fact, if someone is a Muslim and he wants to become a U.S. citizen, they should say, if you pledge allegiance to this Constitution, what you're saying is, I renounce Muhammad.
No, you can't. You can't ask them to do that. They have a right to be a Mohammedan, but they have to, adhere to our form of and way of life.
There are people petitioning to invoke Sharia now.
Well, of course, if they want Sharia law, then they cannot be a good American. But they can't be a good Muslim
if they don't implement it.
Well, of course, that would be an effort to change our form of government. When they become citizens, they swear to defend our Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. If they want Sharia law, they're enemies of America.
Well, that's what I think. And
I would agree with you there.
Well,
I'm going to have to let you go because I'm
genial. Thank you, Dr. Stan. I don't completely agree with you on some of this.
That's all right.
But I really like you, a light in the darkness, and keep the light shining.
Well, God bless. Thanks so much, Roger.
Yes.
Let's go to Jeannie. Jeannie, you got about a minute and a half before we have to let you go. Go ahead.
Real short. This ties in. I want Ron to understand what's really happening. Is remember in the biodiversity assessment report, it was a scientific peer report, and it came out of the biodiversity treaty. And what it said that was unsustainable was the fundamentalist religions, and they would terminate. And the three one-God religions was the Jewish, the Christian, and the Muslims.
Right.
And what better way to start a fight between all the one God religions, have them kill each other off, and then the state religion comes in. It's perfect. That's their blueprint.
Let me just suggest that if you'd like to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment that Jeannie is talking about, while we carry it, it's in the Sustainable Development Syllabus. In fact, it's Jeannie's analysis, but I have the original 1,140 or 52-page report, and she's absolutely right. They talk about the real enemy to this move to globalism are the monotheistic religions, the Muslim religion, the Christian religion, and the Jewish religion. And I think this is what it's all about. I don't agree with the Muslims if they want to hurt us. And, I certainly think that we have to fight for America, but we don't have to go over there to do it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who call us to help us as we reach out across America, trying to educate people about what's really going on. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why not give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, there's going to be a great meeting up in Santa Rosa. It's going to be a week from Saturday. It's going to be at the Santa Rosa Christian Church. Anybody who's interested in going up, why, of course, I'm going to be speaking, and Michael Shaw is going to be speaking. Orlean Kulu, who's a frequent guest here, is going to be speaking. And, of course, this is at the Santa Rosa Christian Church on Pacific Avenue in Santa Rosa. If you'd like directions, we can get them for you. But certainly they're going to have breakfast, and the meeting is going to go from about 9:30 to 1 o'clock. I think you'll have a great time, and you'll have an opportunity to really understand what's happening as far as the sustainable development movement is concerned. Sustainable development is simply a code word for taking away your property rights. It's a code word for communism, because the government is going to control everything under sustainable development. So if you'd like to go to the meeting again, it's at Santa Rosa Christian Church a week from this coming Saturday, and you want to get there early for breakfast at 8:30. Okay, then the next thing I want to mention is that I am going to be putting on the program at our yearly meeting, our yearly seminar. It's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and of course it's going to be there on the 29th of October, and we do hope many of you will get your reservations in early and bring as many people as you can. We're going to have Constance Cumby and Chris Pinto. We're going to have Sidney Michael Shaw will be there. Barrett Schultz will be there. We're going to have a great list of speakers, an opportunity to meet people from all across the country who are concerned about what's going on. That's the 29th of October. You're going to need reservations, so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. I want to mention we're going to be making a ready-reserve food. We're going to be arranged so that you can actually get your ready-reserve food, and you need a food supply on hand because we're moving into World War III. I don't know whether it's going to be a matter of months or years, but there's no question this is going to happen, and there are going to be terrible reprisals on America. So if you need supplies or emergency supplies, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for a food catalog. We have a health catalog. We, of course, have our regular catalog. And all of these things go to help us maintain our network of about 60 stations every single week. That's 60 stations, including Internet and shortwave and all the other items. But we do need your help to continue doing what we're doing. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in knowing about the Berkey water filters, if you're interested in learning about the foods that are available, the long-term storage foods that you should have on hand, or the healthcare products, the vitamins and minerals that Barbara and I take. And as you know, I'm 77 now. Doing pretty well, all in all. But, of course, that's because my wife provides all sorts of vitamins and minerals and special things that really give you the energy to keep right on going. And they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. If you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. If you'd like to get the Sustainable Development Syllabus that has so much in it that you really need to know about what's going on, and if you ever have a question in your mind as to really what's unfolding, what's behind this whole idea of unbridled immigration, and of course it's an effort to destroy America, but it all gets back to one thing, a new world order and a new world religion. So let me simply suggest that you call us at 1-800-544-8927, get the Sustainable Development Syllabus, get the Sustainable Development a four-tape set, but I think probably the best thing to do would be to get the video that goes with the syllabus, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening we have with us Barrett Schoes, and her website is crossroad.to. That's crossroad, not no S on it, crossroad.to for Tonka. And Barrett is really one of the finest researchers we have, and she wrote an article I just read this morning on conspiracy. Now, of course, people ridicule those people who say there's a conspiracy in the world, and yet, you know, if you go back and you read the story of John Wilkes Booth shooting President Lincoln, he was part of a conspiracy. They executed five or six people who were associated with that assassination. There was a conspiracy behind the assassination of President Lincoln. There was a conspiracy behind Watergate. There was a conspiracy behind the Iran-Contra. It was all a conspiracy. But there are lots of conspiracies out there. They all, at least the major ones, are bound together by a common goal. And that is to bring about a new world order and a new world religion. But most people, even many people, I'm sure, who are involved in these movements, do not understand what it's really all about. All they know is what they're supposed to know. Well, Barrett has done a wonderful article that I recommend to you, and it's up on her webpage. It's called, well, I'm going to let Barrett tell about it. Barrett, what motivated you to write this article on conspiracy?
Well, you know, you alerted me to what was going on years ago. You sent me Brotherhood of Darkness, and that was such a wake-up call. I remember thinking, I would love to just take all of your, you know, just take out the key quotes, your statements and the quotes in the book, going back, you know, over a century, and just outline it for the people who come to our website. Because when you begin to look at what people were saying and doing, the plans that were laid, the secret plans, desire for secrecy, and yet allowing just so much information that at least people could begin to be familiar with certain notions from a very positive point of view, so that, you know, they wouldn't have to spring huge surprises on people. But to see the control building in every facet of our government was just amazing, and to see the participation, the funding going from United States and England to Russia to Nazi Germany to fascist Italy. There was so much happening that we had absolutely no idea of. And in those countries that we considered totalitarian and enemies to freedom were actually supported by Americans. And all of this is documented. And, you know, it's amazing. So that has been on my mind all these years, Dr. Stan, since I read your book and since I began to receive information from Dennis Cuddy. So, you know, my research primarily is based on information that I have gathered and the books that I have read, such as Carol Quigley's amazing book, which pretty much lays it all out, and he was part of the conspiracy.
That is Tragedy and Hope, a History of the World in Our Time by Professor Quigley, an excellent book.
Right. I think you told me about that, too, many, many years ago, Dr. Stan. So, you know, all I am doing is putting it back together in a readable form for people who believe that conspiracies need to be preceded by the word theory, you know, or followed by the word theory. And it's ridiculous. Again, that's part of the whole process of misinformation, of ridiculing what is true or the truth that they don't want to be known.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Barrett Schoes. Well, go ahead, Barrett.
Well, it's amazing anyway. So here, you know, what's happening today, we're seeing many of the pieces that were just in the thoughts and the imaginations
utopian dreams of men a century ago are now all falling together. We see what they hope to build, a world society, a new world order. That word has been used incredibly many times, and yet it's almost like we're afraid, no, that can't be for real. Yes, it is for real, and it's written in books of men who have influenced, literally influenced the world. Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan's, Carnegie's, the various foundations, the wealthy bankers. None of this is as mysterious and elusive and imaginary as many people think it is. It is for real.
Don't forget Thomas Lamont.
Thomas Lamont, and with his great-grandson, Ned Lamont, who just won over Joe Lieberman in Connecticut, fits together.
And I bet there's not one in a thousand Americans who has any idea who Ned Lamont really is, or why is it significant that his great-grandfather was Thomas Lamont, who worked with J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, he was the head manager of J.P. Morgan, one of the most powerful people in the world, if not the most powerful person as far as working behind the scenes. There is so many connections that we can now see, and so much of this, like the Lamont family and other family legacies, it's amazing. Should we just talk a little bit about Thomas Lamont?
You go right ahead, and you just pick up, and I'll just sit here and listen, because I think it's so important that we go through these things.
Well, let's start at the beginning and go back to 1913. Both you and I have read Woodrow Wilson's book, and I haven't read it. It's online, but you have the actual book, and I've only read certain parts of it. But I want to just read one quote that I know you have shared with your listeners before. But back in 1913, he said, "Some of the biggest men in the U.S. in the field of commerce and manufacturing are afraid of somebody, are afraid of something. They know there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." This is from his book, New Freedom, that was written in 1913, or published in 1913. He was very aware of what was happening. And, of course, he was drawn into it eventually, probably not that much at that particular time when he wrote that book, but certainly after he became president and became part of what was happening at the highest level of our government in those days, he was drawn into it. But to him, it was frightening, and certainly against the very lofty and noble ideals that he held when he first came into the presidency. And I have both of his two inaugural addresses in front of me. And again, you just see, I don't think, especially the first one, is pure idealism or propaganda. The second one would be more propaganda. But he hoped for a free, honest, good America. Let me just read one statement from his inaugural address.
For our listeners out there, we're talking about Woodrow Wilson, who had in 1913 had written a book called The New Freedom, in which it talked about this secret group that was out there. And as he said, since I've been in public life, men have come to me and they're afraid of something. They know there's a power out there, and he talks it so pervasive. And you really need to read the exact quotation. And you get this feeling, this ominous force that is out there that Woodrow Wilson recognized, that dominated the country, and men were afraid to speak of this. I mean, the leaders of our country who'd come to him were afraid to speak openly about this. In fact, they would never speak above their breath when they spoke in condemnation of this invisible force that in 1913 controlled our nation. So pick up the story there. You were talking about Woodrow Wilson's inaugural speeches?
Yes. Well, his first inaugural address in 1913, he said, "Rid the great government," talking about our United States government was many deep secret things which we too long delayed to look into and scrutinize with candid, fearless eyes. The great government we loved has too often been made use of for private and selfish purposes, and those who use it have forgotten the people. I'm not 100% sure he's referring to that same dark, subtle, watchful, interlocked conspiracy in that sentence, but I tend to think it is, because he's talking about powerful men who are influencing the country and are behind the government, who promote their own private purposes and have forgotten the real needs of people. And that's a pretty consistent description of what's been going on with the Rockefellers, with J.P. Morgan, with this whole interlock group, the core group or the round tables and consular foreign relations and various groups that are interconnected in the United States, England, and European countries, and who have had their sight on the world government for over a century.
And I think this is really what people don't understand. People say, how could possibly a conspiracy go on for 100 years? Well, the way it goes is because there's a spiritual force that is energizing these people. And those of people who've read the prophecies know that they call for, in the end times, a world government. And that is what all of these secret organizations, and they're all listed in Brotherhood of Darkness. There are a dozens, really, of these secret organizations in one form, working sometimes at odds and sometimes together. But they all have a common goal, in one world government and a one world religion, and the destruction of Christianity and what's going on today is part of this conspiracy against God. That's really what it's about. So pick up the story there, please.
Well, maybe we'll read there. But first, maybe I may just remind our listeners, those of you who have a Bible, who love God and know His and treasure His Word, take a look in your concordance and look for the word conspire or conspiracy. And you will find dozens of illustrations of actual conspiracies in the Old Testament, especially, of course, in the history of Judah and Israel in the divided kingdom. But as you go on, you will see it in Assyria and, of course, Babylon and Egypt, and all of the different countries would engage in conspiracies. It's a common thing throughout history. You see it in Renaissance Europe. Incredibly murderous wars were started because there was behind-the-scenes decision that something could be gained. And, of course, more so after the Renaissance Europe and thereafter, because of the competition for markets in the United States and in the Far East and in South America and so on. I don't mean United States, but North and South America was, of course, a very wealthy area in the eyes of the merchants who would bring products back and sell overseas. But this became really important to the people. And again, if you read the history, I'm going to do a chronology of such conspiracies so we can see that this has always been part of human nature. But again, now let's go look at Carol Quigley and some of the quotes from his book. Many might remember that President Clinton referred to Quigley in his it was in his address at the Democratic Convention back in 1992.
That's when he accepted the Democratic nomination for the presidency. It was in July
14th, right,
I think. And he mentioned Professor Quigley in that speech.
Yes, and he was talking about how much he had influenced him. I don't remember his words, but he commended him. He honored Quigley and held him up in great respect. So with that background on Carol Quigley, and you could probably, you may want to add to his background and to show his credibility, but let me just read one statement here. This is one that I think some of our listeners will be familiar with, but he wrote, "There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the Communist Act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the round table groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other group, and frequently does so. I know of the operation of this network because I've studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. In general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown. And it's interesting that he wrote that, and yet he made it known through his book. And I believe I read that the records, the plates for that, the original book, were destroyed. But by that time, enough books were in circulation that it has been reprinted and so on. Isn't that correct, Dr. Stan?
Well, yes. Basically, what happened was that when the book came out in 1966, a lot of people were amazed to find that Professor Quigley was talking about this secret society, and it didn't have a chance to go through their records. And so after about a year, when, of course, the more and more conservatives were beginning to talk about the book, somebody bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and actually destroyed the plates of the first half of the book, and then lied to Professor Quigley and saying they were going to reprint it, when, of course, they destroyed the plates, and they had no intention of doing that. And we actually have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story, and you can actually hear him tell it in his own voice. Eventually, somebody had a copy of the book. They began printing it as pirate copies without copyright permission, and the publisher refused to sue them, so they eventually went to Professor Quigley and offered him $3 a book copyright, for his permission to go ahead and publish the book. Which he gave because he wanted the $3 a book, and he was happy, and that's how the book got in circulation. After Professor Quigley died, the rights were given to three professors, because there was a quarrel between Professor Quigley's wife and Professor Quigley's mistress as to who was the guy with the rights, so they gave it to three professors. Two of them are dead. The third one doesn't seem to be very concerned, and so a friend of mine actually prints the book. It is available now. Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, one of the most important single books you'll ever read.
Yes, I believe that, Dr. Stan. I'll read one more statement. The following page, continuing with the quote that I read a moment ago, he goes on to say, at the end of the war in 1914, at the end of the war of 1914, that's the First World War, it became clear that the organization of the secret of the system had to be greatly extended. The task was entrusted to Lionel Curtis, who established in England and each dominion a front organization to the existing local roundtable group. This front organization, called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, had as its nucleus in each area the existing submerged roundtable group. In New York, it was known as the Council of Foreign Relations and was a front for J.P. Morgan and Company. This is a company which was headed for a while by Thomas Lamont, the great-grandfather of Ned Lamont, who won the election in
Connecticut recently.
Right. In fact, the original plans for the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council of Foreign Relations were drawn up at Paris. And, of course, that was in 1919 at the peace conference they decided also to create the League of Nations.
Right, and Thomas Lamont was there. He was there. Of course, Colonel House really ran that. It was a group called the Inquiry. And these were the people who, of course, justified World War I because they wanted the horror of the carnage of that war to lead to a world government. That's the reason it was fought. There was no reason for World War I if you go back and study it. It doesn't make any sense. You stand on the hillside there at Verdun and realize that 400,000 Frenchmen fell there and 400,000 Germans and Italians fell in that senseless war, that senseless battle at Verdun. But you see, there really are people who want this horror because they feel that this is going to lead to world government and peace. So they fight perpetual wars for perpetual peace. That's what it's all about. And that, of course, is exactly what we're doing in the Middle East today. Perpetual wars for perpetual peace. Please go ahead, Barrett.
Well, let's read something from the Congressional Record of 1917. it's reported that J.P. Morgan banking interests and their subsidiary organizations got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select the most influential newspapers in the United States and sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press in the United States. They found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 of the greatest papers, and an editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit information. Now, this was essential back in the earlier part of last century because, again, they needed to build up the public support for participation in World War One. And just as in Soviet Union, I keep remembering this group of people, J.P. Morgan, supported communist groups as well as fascist governments. It didn't matter what the ideology was if it served their government, and so they would use propaganda to prepare the minds of the masses to embrace their collective vision of a new world order. I quoted from the Brotherhood of Darkness in my article, and I think you, I just want to read that statement. The chief, well, this is, you were quoting Quigley, and you said, the chief problem of American political life has been how to make the two congressional parties more national and international. The argument that the two parties should represent opposed ideals and policies, one perhaps of the right and the other of the left, is a foolish idea acceptable only to the doctrinaire and the academic thinkers. Instead, the two parties should be almost identical so that the American people can, quote, throw the rascals out, unquote, at any election without leading to any profound or extensive shift in policy. This is, again, from Quigley's book.
That's at page 1247, 1248. It's really such an important, what it goes on to say, and then in the end, why, of course, you throw the rascals out, but there's no change in foreign or domestic policy. That's what it's all about. And so we get rid of Bill Clinton, we bring in George Bush, but nothing much changes except George Bush spends more money and gets us involved in wars that President Clinton never could have gotten us involved in. And, of course, President Bush passes a lot of legislation like the No Child Left Behind legislation. Ted Kennedy couldn't get that through. It was Ted Kennedy's bill.
Right.
And George Bush got it through for him. The Medicare drug bill, that was Ted Kennedy's bill. George Bush got it through for him. People don't understand it's all a scam. And, of course, the Republicans are supposed to be pro-life. How many unborn babies have they saved? Have they tried to repeal Roe versus Wade? All they have to do is pass legislation and put a rider on it saying the Supreme Court can't do anything about it. But they have never done that. So they say what we want to hear. But you never judge people by what they say. Judge them by what they do. And the Bush administration is putting out more money for family control and international abortion than the Clinton ever could have possibly done. President Bush has the full support, of course, of the Christians in this country, the evangelical Christians and the Catholics, because they think he is pro-life. But how many unborn children's lives has he really saved? And if you look at it, he really hasn't saved any. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Barrett Cho. We're talking about her article, which is just up on her website now, on conspiracies. It's well worth your reading several times. At crossroad.to. That's crossroad.to. Please pick up the story there.
Well, let me give another illustration of what this system looks like to those who are not part of it and yet are concerned about America. In 1922, New York City Mayor John Hyland described the oppression that he saw that was spread by this treasonous conspiracy. He said, "The real menace of our republic is this invisible government which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. Like the octopus of real life, it operates under cover of a self-created screen. It seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive offices, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, in every agency created for public protection. Of course, those powerful tentacles would prop up organizations that were fighting to destroy American freedom.
And, of course, in that speech, he actually mentioned Rockefeller, Standard Oil, and, of course, some of the corporations that they controlled. But he specifically mentioned the Rockefellers as part of this octopus that was strangling the very heart out of America. And, of course, the Rockefellers and the bankers, and he mentioned the bankers as well, the international bankers, of course, who J.P. Morgan was the prototype of, they have controlled our government for well over a century, and most people really don't understand. We go to the polls every 4 years to vote not for the candidate of our choice, but for the candidate of their choice. It's time the American people understood that, and understood that maybe God is bringing his punishment on our nation. Go ahead, Barrett.
Well, I have a whole lot of quotes here. A chronology of Rockefeller involvement in mental health and eugenics and involved in what was going on in Auschwitz extermination camp. Obviously, he was supporting Mandela's program in executing the people, the prisoners, the Jews and Christians and so on at Auschwitz. Rockefeller was involved in so many different things. Those who are interested in looking up that chronology of Rockefeller involvement in mental health particular, but I think it's called Rockefeller and Global Mind Control, can go to our section of quotes and excerpts. And in a section on brainwashing there, you will find a page on Rockefeller with a chronology, and that might be of interest. But we won't look at that now, probably, because I think we're going to run out of time, but if we do at the end, we could go through some of those. But let's go back to Lamont. Thomas Lamont is referred to by Quigley also, and you might want to read that so that, again, we can tie all of this together. Quigley wrote, Dr. Stan, he mentioned that, but let me quote you here, because you tied this together. You said, the chief evidence can be found in the files of the House of Un-American Activities Committee, which show Tom Lamont, a senior partner in J.P. Morgan and Company, his wife Flora, and his son Corliss, as sponsors and financial angels to almost a score of extreme left organizations, including the Communist Party itself. Now, this is from your book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. And I just suggest everyone that listens, read it. It's not over 1,000 pages long like Tragedy and Hope, but it gives you all the information needed to put the whole picture together. It's so good. So, anyway, there's our Thomas Lamont, again, the great-grandfather of Ned Lamont. And we might just look for a moment. We've mentioned several times that Thomas Lamont headed up. He was chairman of J.P. Morgan, and Morgan, of course, was involved in all these different things that we've discussed. Corliss Lamont, who's the son of Thomas Lamont, and Corliss, of course, is the grandfather of Ned Lamont, was trained for his role as a conspirator at Harvard, at Oxford, at Columbia University. His roommate during his studies at Oxford was the Fabian socialist Julian Huxley, the brother of Aldous Huxley and the first director general of the UNESCO. And it might be good just to look at what Corliss Lamont might have learned from Julian Huxley. So I want to quote from Huxley's book that he wrote soon after he became head of UNESCO.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to just hold that for just a moment, and we'll read it now, and then, of course, when we get back from this break, we'll read it. People have to understand that Julius and Aldous Huxley were dedicated socialists. They were also key players in this, along with Corliss Lamont and Thomas Lamont. Yes, and now, two generations later, Ned Lamont, who's running for the Senate in Connecticut. All right, Barrett, just go right ahead.
All right, this is This is from Julian Huxley's book on UNESCO and its philosophy. He said, quote, taking the techniques of persuasion and information and true propaganda that we have learned to apply nationally in war and deliberately bending them to the international tasks of peace, if necessary, utilizing them as Lenin envisioned to overcome the resistance of millions to desirable change. The task before UNESCO is single. The task is to help the emergence of a single world culture. At the moment, two opposing philosophies of life confront each other. You may categorize the two philosophies as, and I'm going to skip a section here and then go on, individualism versus collectivism, or capitalism versus communism, or Christianity versus Marxism. Then he asks, can these opposites be reconciled, this antithesis be resolved in a higher synthesis? I believe not only that it can happen, but through the inexorable dialectic of evolution, it must happen. Now, here he is summarizing what is being taught to students in this country and literally around the world through UNESCO's World Education System. It's dialectic thinking. Children learn that from kindergarten on right now. You get into your small groups and you share your thoughts and you have a facilitator that help you reconcile all kinds of differences and opposites into a new synthesis. Christian children have to set aside their biblical absolutes and think like the people in the class who believe in other gods and other values and so on, until everyone is so flexible, everyone has let go of the anchor of their mind that has anchored them in certain facts and truth, and will become willing for the sake of group belonging and the good feeling you get from agreeing with people and being nice in the sense of, I'm going to be so tolerant that I'm going to give up my convictions for your sake. This is what Julian Huxley was talking about. And he said this was necessary in order to create the right kind of propaganda and to overcome the resistance of millions to the change that they had planned. So, this is an amazing statement because it pretty much lays out the philosophy, the conspiratorial philosophy of transforming the world and creating global solidarity, which, of course, it's a word we hear more and more and read more and more in the newspaper. But this was then Corliss Lamont's roommate, Julian Huxley. And not only did Corliss Lamont...
Just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Barrett Chosen, and she's simply talking about the fact that Corliss Lamont, and I think they were at Oxford together with Julian Huxley. And of course, Huxley was a dedicated socialist, but so was Corliss Lamont. And if you go into the records of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, you'll find that Corliss Lamont was financing communist organizations and belonging to communist front organizations. And it is because of this that Professor Quigley said, you know, there was an inside joke. There were a lot of course, people who thought the communists were behind all the things going on following the Second World War, beyond turning Eastern Europe over to the communists and China over to the communists, and, you know, certainly behind the no-win war in Korea and all of these things. They think it's the communists and the communists and the New York Times. He says it isn't at all. It is this group, and he referred to them as the Anglo-American establishment, but he was referring to people like Thomas Lamont and Corliss Lamont and all of these people of great wealth who were actually financing and helping communism because it was a means of diversion so that people would not understand that the major driving force behind socialism and communism in America, whose goal was centralizing all power with government and ripping the heart out of our Constitution and centralizing power in the hands of very few. It was these people of great wealth, not the communists, who were really doing it. The communists were simply a diversion, so you would never understand who was really intent upon centralizing all power with Washington and creating a new feudalistic form of society here in America. So pick up the story there, please, Jared.
Yeah, all right. When Corliss went to Columbia, he was studying under the humanist professor J. John Dewey. Now, most of us are familiar with John Dewey. We have a long chronology on the National Education Association and the roots of the liberalism in the education system. And, of course, John Dewey was the primary guru to the original education leaders at Columbia and worked together with many of those who came over from Europe, from the Tavistock Institute and the Frankfurt Institute. When Hitler came into power, they had to leave the country. They came to this country, to Columbia, Stanford Research Institute, and various educational laboratories, where they began to put together the strategies for changing the minds of children and, of course, adults, but to actually implement the new psychological strategies of education. And so Corliss was learning this from John Dewey. And it's not very surprising that when he received his PhD in 1928, he wrote a thesis in which he denied the existence of God and tried to disprove both biblical truth and the validity of hope in eternal life. Now, this idea of undermining hope is really important as far as undermining, you know, Christian hope. This is one of the reasons why the biggest enemy to the success of this whole system is biblical Christianity. Because when we belong to Jesus Christ, we believe in Jesus Christ and belong to God, and he opens our eyes to see his ways and his truth, our hope is in eternity with him. Our hope is in what Jesus Christ has done and what he will do to us and what he and being with him throughout eternity. And that doesn't fit. This is one of the reasons there was so much brainwashing among American prisoners. They had to learn to think like economists. And basically, the economists thinking based on the Hegelian dialectic, which always tries to synthesize opposites, is pretty much what these people want all of the world to embrace at this point, because that system allows the leaders to totally to rule, to control the people. You can control the masses if you can take them away from any absolutes, distract them, as Aldous Huxley suggested in the Brave New World, through all kinds of government-provided entertainment and medications, feel-good medications, and the feely-feelies, good feelings, I mean, celebration of this imagined God, all the different things that bring people together, erode barriers and boundaries, and make people incapable of taking a stand on anything, so that they are almost forced to just flow with the changes. This is where we're headed, and this is what we saw in communism, but this is why Christianity doesn't fit. And we can talk about that for long, because there are all kinds of assaults, as we know, on the church today, which fits right into this conspiracy. And it would be important to look at that at some other time. But right now, let me just read one more statement here. This is according to the Wall Street and Bolshevik Revolution, a book by Anthony Sutton. I just like to read it, give a little more facts as a background to how the Morgans and the Rockefellers supported the communist belief system and communism as a system. Anthony Sutton writes, quote, "There is evidence of transfer of funds from Wall Street bankers to international revolutionary activities. For example, there is a statement substantiated by a cablegram by William Boyce Thompson, a director in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. A large stockholder in the Rockefeller-controlled Chase Bank and a financial associate of the Guggenheims and the Morgans, that he, Thompson, contributed $1 million to the Bolshevik Revolution for propaganda purposes." And then he goes on to say, "Of all the American business leaders, the one who most vigorously patronized the cause of fascism was Thomas Lamont, head of the powerful J.P. Morgan banking network. Lamont served as something of a business consultant to the government of fascist Italy. Lamont secured a $100 million loan for Mussolini in 1926 at a particularly crucial time for the Italian dictator. You might remember, too, that he was the director of the Guaranteed Trust. Was the father of Corliss Lamont, a domestic communist. And, of course, Corliss Lamont, again, is the grandfather of Ned Lamont.
Who just defeated, of course, Lieberman, Joe Lieberman, in the Connecticut senatorial primary. So it's really fascinating to see how this all fits together. What's even more interesting is that once Ned Lamont would have won, then who was rallying behind Ned Lamont? Why, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and all of the Democratic Party faithful.
And all the newspapers that were controlled by CFR.
Right. And of
because it was interesting. It was like all of a sudden he says he's running. None of the newspapers exposed his background, the family background. In fact, they gave misinformation because they suggested that he was an unknown.
Uh-huh.
Somebody who all of a sudden, a fresh young man who was just free from any of the old entanglements. He hasn't been on the political scene. And they didn't give any history, and of course they must have known the history, but that was kept quiet. Instead, there was just a lot of support for him all of a sudden, which you wouldn't ordinarily find for a newcomer like that. And of course he won. Even that was a strange situation because the day of the election, somebody sabotaged his website. And so those people who were looking for a way knew that they could contact his website to find out where to get rides to the polling places, couldn't get into his website. It had crashed that day.
Well, now, was that Lieberman or Lamont?
That was Lamont. Okay. No, that was Lieberman's who had, yeah. Lieberman's website had been sabotaged.
Right.
Hacked.
Well, of course, these people are really very, very ruthless. They've been ruthless for a long time. And, of course, it was, this group of people who financed the tyrannical Russian Revolution and financed Lenin and financed Stalin. We have always financed communism. It was the best enemy money could buy. And while our attention was focused on the danger of communism and people were joining anti-communist organizations, here in the United States, the same people who were financing the anti-communist movement were also financing the communist movement. It's a game they play. In fact, Professor Quigley points out how one of the primary partners of J.P. Morgan was financing the right wing, and the other partner, Thomas Lamont, was financing the left wing. They play both sides against the middle, and the average American has no idea what's really going on.
And yet they need those for the dialectic process in order to train people to speak dialectically, to somehow justify other positions, the opposite. You need to talk about it, and by bringing it into the conversation, people begin to reconcile those two opposites, and that kind of synthesis fits right into the new communitarian systems that we're hearing more and more about. Remember Tony Blair, in one particular conversation with Clinton, back when Clinton was president, they were both talking about the third way, and Blair discussed how he saw the third way as the way to go. And of course, the third way is communitarianism. The third way, I think people defined it back then as it's not capitalism, but neither is it pure communism. It's the third way, communitarianism. and, of course, now this is where we're going with so much of both government and around the world. It's the idea that somehow you have to create a social welfare system within the social sector of society, the social sector being society, The public sector is government, the private sector is business, and then your social sector are the churches, the community groups, the people who are just living in a community together, and so you'll need to emphasize the social service and bring people together with a common purpose of serving the greater whole, which brings us back to kind of the noble illusions and the propaganda for both fascism and communism. But the third way is being pushed very much by our president today, and certainly by the United Nations, and in the various attempts to fix the problem in Africa. It's the third way. You know, you have to pour money into the country from outside, and then work with the government. But the government, through the government, you set the standards, and you measure, you create accountability. But within that system, the people. Let's see, am I making sense here, Dr. Stan? If you bring together the three sectors, this is Peter Drucker too, and this is the purpose-driven church, and everything fits into this system as it's promoted abroad, and especially in Rwanda and Africa. You take the government controls everything, but the business and the society, the civil society. Will do much of the work, but the government controls everything. So, unlike in communism, where the government owns everything, here people can own, but the government controls both what you own and the way you use it, and how you function in society.
But of course, this is exactly what's happened in America. This is what sustainable development is all about.
Right.
It's all about, you know, you can own your property, but you just can't do anything with it. You can't sell it. You can pay your taxes on it. We're going to control it because there might just be an endangered species or a wet zone or a little flower or bud or something that's endangered. And so basically it is a means of bringing everything under the control of a ruling elite, a bureaucratic elite.
Right.
And the average American doesn't understand what's going on. He thinks we're a nation of laws, we should obey these laws, without understanding that these laws have been passed by people who do not believe in our way of life. It's all about power and control.
Right. And of course, that, again, goes back to what we were discussing earlier, that it doesn't matter if these people who are part of the conspiracy support both capitalism and communism and Nazism and all the different facets, why they would say, yes, you can talk about being, you know, they pretend to say Christianity is okay, but so is all other, you know, pluralism and interfaith and so on, because what they want is a blend of everything, bring everything out in the open, talk about it, and then create a synthesis and train people to continually think and work in terms of synthesis.
And of course, there are no absolutes. Everything is in a state of change. But behind all of this is a common goal. They want to destroy Christianity. They want you to begin to compromise your positions.
Right.
Eventually, they, of course, want to do away with Christianity. And traditional thought will overuse the good parts of Christianity, where they help people, you know, sort of like everybody helps one another, the Rodney King idea, can't we all get along together? But the teachings of Christianity and the teachings of grace, why, these will be forgotten as we begin to merge our religion with the other religions of the world. That's what it's about.
That's right. I mean, you can call it Christianity, but if it's a belief system where you still believe sort of in the universal God, you take out the cross, you take out redemption, atonement, the need to come to Christ, and understand who he is, how he has revealed himself. If you take all that out, including hope and eternal life, and you call it Christianity when you go out and serve, that's not Christianity. But that kind of Christianity would fit into the envisioned pluralism for a global interfaith society. Now, I think we might, you know, where does all of this then fit in with biblical truth? Because I think what we've been talking about sounds so hopeless and pessimistic, and can we stop this downward slide, this this destruction of everything that we have appreciated about America and where are we headed? But I think they have to remember that in the middle of all of this, our God reigns, and there's no question about that. Let's go to, just for a moment, Psalm 2, which asks the question in the beginning, why do the nations rage and the people plot the vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast their cords from us. That's Psalm 2. That was written a long, long time ago, more than 2,000 years ago.
Close to 3,000 years ago, because it was written by David. It was about 3,000 years ago, 1,000 years B.C. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Well, somebody said recently that what we want is a God without wrath, to deal with man without sin, heaven without judgment, and certainly Christ without a cross. And if we can just simply make Christianity more acceptable to people and not have all these old myths in there, everybody's going to be real happy with it. But the trouble is, God without wrath and man without sin and heaven without judgment and Christianity without a cross is not Christianity. And yet that is what is being encouraged in the purpose-driven church of today.
Well, it feels good, it sounds good, it removes all moral boundaries. Again, it's very much like the kind of spirituality that was promoted in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, because it fits, it unifies. It means everybody's just nice to each other, and you believe there is some kind of a kind, benevolent God who will help us when we need help. But you can do whatever you feel like. In fact, some of it is coming closer to the kind of Gnostic idea that if you can just have a spiritual experience, again, like in Brave New World, where you come together and you feel the mysteries of the presence of this imagined God, but he doesn't hold you accountable to moral standards or certain behaviors, and there are no laws, no absolute laws, then it works, then it fits right in. We probably just have a minute or two left.
You've got about 1 minute left.
Okay. Well, I just want to go to the end of Psalm 2 because it's just a great reminder. The very last verse of Psalm 2 says, blessed are those who put their trust in him. And that's what we need to do. And we need to remember that our God, who is sovereign and who created the world and who knows the end before the beginning, as he tells us through Jeremiah, he is using all of this. Nothing is happening apart from his wisdom and understanding. And he told us there was going to be a world government at the end. And he told us it was going to be scary and dangerous and we would face persecution, as Christians have faced from the very beginning. But he is our shelter and our strength and our wisdom, and he's everything we need. He will provide when and if things get hard. We don't know what his schedule is, but the coming together of a world government that despises him fits right in with Scripture. It fits in with Revelation. It fits in with Luke 21.
We're out of time. Hold that thought for just a minute. And, of course, Barrett was just saying that the coming together of this world government is prophesied, and we see a lot of terrible things happening, and we hear, wars and rumors of wars, and I really believe that we're going to expand the war in the Middle East. I think that's exactly what's planned. But, of course, if we focus on what's happening without realizing the spiritual implications, we'd be frightened to death. But I think the message of this program tonight, is it puts your faith in the Lord and understand we truly are involved in a spiritual battle being paid out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Barrett Schoes, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
And again, if you go to Barrett's website, that's crossroad.to, pull it down, material down, copy it, file it away, read it through repeatedly, a great deal of wisdom there. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Barry.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stan. My privilege.
Good night, and God bless. Okay, well, that was Barry Chose, and I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you go to our website and pull down that article on the conspiracies, or if you don't have access to it, of course, we'd be glad to send you a copy if you just call us, and we'll send it to you free of charge. Then, of course, I hope many of you will want to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. We do have Professor Quigley's long-suppressed book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. We even have an interview with Professor Quigley, and it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. To begin to put this all together, you really need to get our three little pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. They're three pamphlets, they're inexpensive. They actually will begin to help you to understand, because you see, if you just look at what's going on, and you look at the events without understanding the history behind them or the spiritual forces behind them, so much of what's going on doesn't make sense. Why won't Iran agree to negotiate with America? Why would you do everything you can to antagonize America? Why would President Ahmadinejad be talking about wiping Israel off the face of the earth unless he was encouraging an attack on America? And why is America falling into his trap? I believe there is a cosmic script. I believe it's being followed. And once we understand that, once we understand that nothing that is happening really makes sense, but it is all drawing us, without our consent, many times, our knowledge into this terrible confrontation in the Middle East that will have tremendous ramifications right here at home. So once you understand that, please pray for America and pray for revival, because if we don't have revival, we're going to lose this country. And there may be nothing we can do, but our job is to do our best and try to lead people to a personal relationship with our Lord. Now, let me just mention that Radio Liberty is dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs for your help. We do, of course, carry the Berkey products. We're now carrying a food, if you'd like, a food catalog for storage food, because I believe everybody should be making preparations. Now, we don't know whether they'll do us any good, but I think we're called to make the preparations for ourselves and our families, and that, of course, you know, after we've done the very best we can, if we are to survive what lies ahead, we can help others. But we are to do our best and then, of course, pray as if it's up to the Lord. So if you'd like to get our catalog and health products, if you'd like to know more about the Berkey products, if you'd like to know more about the food products we're carrying, and I think everybody should have a good supply of food on hand, and you can get it through Radio Liberty, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. If you'd like the four tape set on the secret government that contains the interview with Professor Quigley. If you'd like to get our material on the supernatural, the four tape set, where you'll actually hear Johanna Michelson, who is a medium with supernatural power, tell about her experience as a psychic healer or with a psychic healer, and then help us get the word out across America. Please pray for America. And, of course, encourage others to listen to our program. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it's Wednesday, the 6th of September. Holy mackerel, 2006. Yep, here it comes, folks. Fifth anniversary on its way. And checking some of the polls that have been taken over the past couple